Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we chat with the editor of a new magazine focusing on filmmaking in Champaign-Urbana. We have an interview with Star Trek's George Takei, an essay about life without television, and we hear about the Sterling Institute, what some may call a masculinity cult, and how they try to get men to attend their very expensive men's weekend retreats. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Most of us couldn't think of life without television, but for essayist Deb Aronson, living in a TV-less world came by accident, an accident she is now grateful for.
My family mourned the death of our television. It was a lingering illness, and we took no heroic measures. Still, we hoped against hope for a miracle cure. Every once in a while, one of us would wander over and stab at the buttons, hoping for some sign of life. Alas, by the end, there was none, not even a little static. The entertainment center became a mausoleum. In the following weeks, however, peace and quiet reigned in our house. Personally, I felt no particular love of the television. When it was around, the television's incessant chatter was like having an ill-mannered house guest who doesn't take the clue that it is time to leave. Every dinner was a battle to get the kids away from their favorite show or advertisement and come to the table. My husband would stay up until all hours watching whatever he might find as he mindlessly flitted from channel to channel. I didn't mean to never get another television, but I didn't run right out and buy a new one either. The thought crossed my mind that an extended break might be just what we all needed. I learned later that the kids thought we couldn't afford a new television. Why else wouldn't we have replaced it immediately? Why indeed? It turns out there are lots of reasons. The whole family started to go to bed at a more reasonable hour, which made us all more pleasant in the morning. Getting everyone to the dinner table was no longer a battle. Our son, who was in second grade at the time, turned to books. The children bickered less. We had full-fledged conversations. Still, sometimes, late at night, after the children were asleep, my husband and I would whisper in the dark about missing our favorite shows and whether we could somehow get a television and the kids wouldn't notice. But really, once the television was gone, we just didn't miss it as much as we thought we would. Once you get out of the habit, it becomes surprisingly easy to not worry so much about any of your favorite characters. You remember that they are just actors, not your pals. And my husband and I agreed that the benefits far outweighed our temporary withdrawal symptoms. I am not and don't intend to become an anti-television evangelist, but I am a fan of simplicity. Why do things or have things that drive us crazy? And the television drove me crazy, like toxic love. Maybe it drove everyone in my family crazy, but they didn't realize until it was gone. People's reactions to our TV-less state have surprised me. Usually it starts with my confessing that we don't have a television when someone refers to some recent advertisement or television show. They look at me with what seems like awe, but maybe it is shock. Many people shake their heads and say, "I should really do that," or "I could never do that," a bit wistfully, as if they could glimpse the promised land, but knew it was not for them. It's tempting to lay a real guilt trip on these people. They seem to be asking for one. Instead, I overcompensate the other way. "Oh, you know, we didn't do it on purpose. It just sort of happened. It's no big deal, really." And it is not a big deal. It's not like we climbed Mount Everest or cured cancer. But then I realize that that is the nature of toxic love. The toxic part is intertwined with the love part, making it difficult to leave in the case of a person, or discard in the case of a television. And in the case of television, is television really all that toxic? What, come to think about it, do I hate about television? Recently, we spent a weekend in St. Louis. We stayed in a hotel, the one place, other than at their grandparents, the kids have unfettered access to a television. And I think I figured out what I hate about the boob tube. It's that glazed zombie stare the kids adopt when they have the television on. It is as if the body snatchers have come for them. If I try to talk to the kids, they don't make eye contact. Their jaws are slack. I can practically see their brains withering. There is not even a way to pause the action and check that they are still alive in there. The only movement is the twitch of their fingers, flipping through the channels. In Ray Bradbury's novel, Fahrenheit 451, people's lives are absorbed by enormous televisions, which, ideally, take up all four walls of the living room and are referred to as parlor walls. Front porches and sidewalks are gone because people spend all their free time in front of their parlor walls with an artificial family played by actors. I'm not saying we're there as a culture yet, but sometimes I feel like we're getting close. Personally, I'd rather keep my front porch, my sidewalks, and my family. And when I weigh that against having a glowing, chattering box that turns my kids into drooling zombies, well, I don't feel so bad about leaving the television dead and buried.
Deb Aronson lives in Urbana with her family without a television. This is Sidetrack. Recently, film critic Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival brought film lovers from around the country together to celebrate cinema. One local film writer felt this was a great opportunity to highlight filmmaking in Champaign-Urbana. Jason Pankokey, the editor of the independent film magazine Microfilm, debuted his new digest magazine, CU Confidential, during Ebert Fest Week. The magazine profiles those in the area who are making interesting independent films. Pankokey, who last talked with us in 2005, recently stopped by the WILL studios to talk about CU Confidential and how he hopes this new magazine will spark a renewed interest in local filmmaking and local film watching.
For those who know Microfilm and its web offshoots, I've always incorporated local film and video making of the independent stripe as part of the plan. It was always my intention to do that, to basically have a grassroots in my backyard representation of what movie making is, or movie culture is, in environments in cities and towns that are not Hollywood, Los Angeles, and or New York.
Well, how strong is the independent film scene in Champaign-Urbana, and are there specific examples of stuff going on right now?
Yes, I think it is stronger than it's been in a while. As far as a local culture, well, I mean, in talking to people, particularly people who have picked this up now and will flip through it in front of me and go, the kind of like variations of the phrase, oh, I didn't know so much was going on around here. Well, that's kind of part of the point of giving the information and the names and the titles its own collected birth in this format with CU Confidential. I will say that there is definitely, several mainstays of the area who do work, whether it's documentary or narrative. There, of course, are sporadic pockets of students doing, projects more for play than for, career gain or anything, but it still is happening. And, of course, I know we've talked in past shows when I've been on about the whole, you know, quote-unquote digital revolution, just the fact that, you know, the movie-making tools are out there more or less for anybody to get a hold of, you know, even lower-budget video cameras and tripods, etc. If you learn how to use the equipment wisely, you can still turn out a nice product with it. People, you know, that more continuously do work, that the nature of it is multiple performance and repetition and just being out there and, you know, giving the public options to hear their music, see their performance, etc. Filmmakers are more like, you know, the cicadas of artists. In other words, because of all, especially the technical behind the scenes work that must go into making a film, you know, even with the digital stuff, you know, it's still a lot of technical work to put it together in the manner that they want to. Even short films, sometimes they do take months. It depends on the nature of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to get across. So usually when you read about filmmakers in the area, especially indigenous ones, people hear doing things, you know, when do you learn about them? Usually one, when they're actually in production and, oh, something's filming, you know, that's kind of the glamour part of it. Something's actually going in front of the camera. And then when it's premiere time. My goal was just to collect all this information about who's doing what now and to get it out into the public in a very portable, efficient format that's kind of fun, a bit different, you know, definitely different from other local publications, specifically the Ebert Fest program, just because, you know, it's talking huge and it's got tons of reviews and that. And this is supposed to be, you know, very efficient, to the point. Hopefully inspiring people to, A, keep an eye out for these people from, you know, as they, you know, go, oh, okay, it's these people now that are doing this. And also to hopefully engage people in starting to communicate more. Whether it's the filmmakers themselves who have their own little camps of their groups and their people they work with. You know, if they start learning more about each other and there's more contact, more encouragement, more just more back and forth between them, and then other people coming from the outside going, hey, this is kind of interesting. I've always wanted to try this. Now I know the people who are the core people. Maybe they got projects coming up that I could have a bit part in it, or I could help design costumes. If we get that more, that cyclical turnover of communication and people working with each other, that's where the scene, if it's meant to be, will come about.
Well, I want to talk to you in just a bit about finding outlets for these filmmakers, but you made a point about, you talked about Ebert Fest, which just recently got over.
Yes.
With, and you timed the release of CU Confidential to coincide with the Ebert Fest. And you yourself, it seems that you're a little ambivalent about the film festival in and of itself. And its relationship to small independent film. I mean, on one hand, that's a lot of what Ebert Fest features, but it also features a lot of big studio films too. I mean, what's your take on the fest that Ebert does, mm-hmm. and its relationship to independent filmmaking and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to showcase?
Yes. Interesting term, ambivalent. I guess we're finally going to go on the record of what does Pankokey think about all this? I actually do enjoy the Ebert Festival. I may sometimes seem more detached to it than, you know, the regular folks who go year after year and they make sure they get their passes and they're there for, you know, one half to all of the films. You know, I kind of jokingly tell people, you know, for me, if I get to see three or four of them every year, it's a blessing. Usually because, you know, what am I doing? I'm doing other projects that, yeah, of course, you know, it's very obvious. Or it should be very obvious why I would time the release of a local movie magazine at the one big, well-known movie event in Champaign-Urbana every year. I think my goal with the timing is to make it a point that even though Ebert himself and a lot of the folks who help program it have been quoted time and time again in saying that the point of the overlooked film, well, it will officially become Ebert Fest starting with next year's edition, that the goal of the Ebert Fest is to bring back into the public consciousness films that, you know, Roger Ebert has felt have been overlooked for some reason or another, or just have not really been presented in the pristine theatrical environment for a long time. And to basically give people the opportunity to enjoy a collective movie-going experience. Obviously, starting with home video 25 years ago, and we've seen how that's erupted as far as an outlet for material, along with now the internet, and with more people getting high speed, they can watch full motion video on their computers. Of course, it's disseminating. There's that much more material to watch, but there's that many more different outlets where one can watch it, which, as far as variety and as far as giving the little guy more cost-effective platforms to get their stuff out there, that's great. But again, I think I used the word mistake a little bit ago. Part of that is, though, what's the grand way to view and to present one's work on the big screen in front of a bunch of people all at once? And it's a communal thing. It's a community thing, obviously. If you would, just kind of hang around Eberfest and just, take a look at all the people who kind of amass before, any given show, it is definitely a cross-pollination. As far as Eberfest and independent films, a decent percentage of the films every year are definitely low-budget labors of love, which does not necessarily mean they look, garbagey or anything like that. Obviously, there's some element of craft and professionalism in the films that's, I'm sure, kind of a factor in deciding what shows. I believe that it should be no sin, especially given the profile and the status of the Ebert Film Festival, to go ahead and acknowledge, the production aspect of it. Yes, it is not Sundance. It is not South by Southwest. It is not a film market. I think that's the big distinction. It is a festival for the love of watching movies and good movies. Everybody's going to have their opinion on whether they like this movie or that movie. That's fine. I think that, this town and this community, though, as far as the filmmakers, there needs to be a bit better synergy. Especially, it comes back to, is there a film scene? Well, it takes all kinds to make it happen.
Well, earlier, I wanted to talk about the outlets for these films and for these filmmakers. And you were talking about usually the only attention these people get is during the production process and then during a premiere process. Where can these films be showcased? And I know you have actually stepped up a couple of times and done showings at a local bar out in a beer garden. Is that something that needs to keep going? Is that something that you're planning to do more of, or other people are planning to do of? I guess I'm getting at is, these local filmmakers are taking all this time and effort to put together a product, tell a story. For movies, there's the two part, there's the filmmaker and then there's the audience. You need to find the audience. So where in this town do you have showings?
It's hard. I won't say it's hard. It takes a lot of work and dedication, and I think that's part of the, kind of the education process of letting just so people understand. No production or artwork or album or whatever, happens in 24 hours, and yay, there it is, and it's out there. You have, the long term creation of something, and then the finalizing of it. And then getting it out there, it's the old, if something makes a sound in the woods and nobody's around to hear it, does it ever really make a sound? Same difference. These folks don't, spend, tons of hours of their lives or whatever to have a movie that nobody sees, regardless if it's 2 hours or, 5 minutes. The core thing is it's obviously part of their job and their prerogative to get the movie out there. For my part of it, you know, I've sporadically tried over the years to do smaller movie shows. You know, I know we've you know, talked recently about you know, the late lamented Freaky Film Festival. For anybody who might not have remember that or might not have been living here when it was going on, it was an honest to goodness indie film festival that took place 4 years in a row from 1997 to 2000, which of course means that it actually preceded the Overlooked Film Festival by about a year and a half when its first edition. And we obviously don't have a public forum, like an annual event or something, for the smaller, more eclectic, the scrappier type of movie making. You know, it could be in the, you know, professionally done, or it could be totally underground or anything in between.
So what's the reaction been so far with CU Confidential? I mean, it's only been out for
a week and a half, 2 weeks. Very good. Many people have commented to me, other than looks great, which of course I'll take as a compliment.
Well, where can people find copies of CU Confidential?
I'm just starting to get copies out there free, you know, take a lot of the free stash and put them out several places in downtown Champaign. I'm starting to get in Campus Town, like That's for Entertainment. A lot of the coffee shops, you'll find small stacks there. I'm gonna plan to have it free for a little while, but then I'm probably gonna collect them temporarily and just, you know, decide more targeted marketing again and where to get these things out there to get the word out there. I also do have thoughts, plans, schemes to possibly reintroduce copies of these as a for sale item, with the main edition being possibly a little DVD sampler of local work. So that's one, and that gets back to how do people see this work? When you see these shows happening, and you know, they're usually pretty apparent if they're local productions. Go check them out, support them, go actually introduce yourself to the filmmakers. Hopefully you like the work, and that's how you make contact with these people. Go to places like That's for Entertainment and ask them, hey, how do you have local movies I can rent? And if they don't, tell them they should get them. If you know of works that are not in the store, suggest them by name. Go to their websites, find out where they're streaming. You know, like streaming is the big thing now with like the MySpace and the YouTube and all these websites that facilitate streaming video. Look for the deluxe edition of CU Confidential in the fall.
That was Jason Pankoki, editor of CU Confidential, a new digest magazine focusing in on filmmaking in the Champaign-Urbana area. To come on the program, an interview with Star Trek's George Takei and the story of a guy and the group that tries to get men to embrace their inner manliness. Stay tuned. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. George Takei is best known as Mr. Sulu from the series Star Trek, but besides his acting career, Takei is politically active with human rights causes. He even tried his hand at politics, running for L.A. City Council in the 1970s. Takei grew up during the Second World War, and in 1942, at the age of 5, he and his family, like many other Japanese Americans, were taken to an internment camp. Takei, who recently revealed publicly he is gay, visited the University of Illinois campus in April to talk about his life and experiences as a gay Japanese-American actor. He sat down with AM580's Michael Kaliska for an interview.
I'll never be able to forget that day when American soldiers with bayoneted rifles came to our front door in Los Angeles and ordered us all out. Of course, my parents knew that we had to go, and we were packed, but it was scary, and we were taken to the swamps of Arkansas. You know, I remember the machine guns pointed at us, when I made the night runs to the latrine, the searchlight that followed me, and it became normal for me to begin the school day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I mean, I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all."
You became an actor at a time where Asian people or any other minorities were, like, you know, hardly to be seen on the screen or on television.
At that time, I really didn't think about that. That's what I enjoyed doing.
But did you ever encounter any problems at the time, you know, having the Japanese background?
My father prepared me for that. He said Asians don't have too many opportunities to make a living at it. And when they do, it's these rather unattractive stereotypes, the comic servant or the black villain. But I was enormously lucky. I was cast in my first big feature film while still a student, a drama student at UCLA. It was Ice Palace, and it was starring Richard Burton.
It sounds to me a little bit like there was kind of something like a split world. And at the time, I mean, minorities weren't really, like, you know, in best shape, at least in terms of what kind of rights they had. So did you feel that there was something like almost like a schizophrenic existence?
No, because that's part of the reality of the world we live in. I was at the same time actively involved in the civil rights movement. What makes America great is its diversity. And in the Screen Actors Guild, we advocate for the realistic depiction of the American scene. How can you have a series that takes place in a hospital in San Francisco without having Asian doctors or Asian patients?
In television, Star Trek was one of the first which kind of, you know, showed this diversity, but somewhere in a far away future, though, and nothing really related to what was going on in the real world.
Well, it was a very optimistic view of the future. But Star Trek served as a change agent, because the reality of the 1960s when we first came on the air was, you know, that was the height of the civil rights movement. The entire world was gripped by the Cold War. And on Star Trek, we depicted a trusted member of the leadership crew who spoke with a Russian accent, proud of his Russian heritage, Chekhov. Sure, that was political fiction. It was social fiction to have Asians and African women and a Scotsman, you know, all working together in concert. It was fiction. But look what's happened in 40 years. Today we have, in fact, a spacecraft which we call the International Space Station. And most astounding of all, once mortal political enemies, Americans and Russians working side by side right up there.
Roughly 2 years ago, October 2005, was the date where the world got to know George is gay. But how was it before? I mean, you've been gay, the public didn't know it. Was it difficult?
Well, you got to remember, I was a teenager in the 50s. Yes, my hormones were telling me what excited me when I was still a child. But, you know, you kind of try to suppress that because the other guys, you know, are finding Monica, you know, busty. Oh, look at that. With me, it was Bobby that was, you know, exciting. I knew that, but I dated girls, you know. I mean, I lived that life of the times. And then I wanted to build an acting career in the 60s, and I wanted to protect that career.
Last question, focus a little bit. What are you doing right now? We've been talking about you doing Heroes, and maybe you can just, like, you know, talk a little bit about how exciting it is for you to do science fiction again.
The extraordinary thing about Heroes is all my scenes are in Japanese with English subtitle, and this on primetime network television. Only art houses used to attract people that would support English subtitle movies, you know. So it's a commentary on diversity and globalization.
As mentioned, George Takei has found a new group of fans due to his latest role on the NBC series Heroes. Takei also appears occasionally on the Howard Stern radio show. He spoke with AM580's Michael Kaliska. You're listening to Sidetrack. The role of men in society is conflicted. On one extreme, there's the hyper-macho jock. On the other is the sensitive nurturer. Most men usually wind up somewhere in the middle of these two extremes. Some, though, feel that men have lost their way and need to revert back to a more traditional masculine role. There's a group, the Sterling Institute, which some might call a masculinity cult, who tries to get men to reclaim their macho side by attending a very expensive self-help weekend. One of the requirements of this group, it seems, is to get others to sign up for the men's weekend. Chris Bell, a friend of independent producer Matt Kessler, was approached by a group of these guys who had attended the weekend, and they were going to do everything in their power to get him to attend too.
My friend Chris isn't macho. He doesn't throw footballs or feed Cheetos to his dog. Most men act like gentlemen in public, and then in closed quarters, let the inner dude loose. Chris never lets the inner dude loose. He's a diplomat, a ranking officer, a commanding general for Team Gentlemen.
My name is Chris Bell. I'm a part right now of a class called Men and Masculinity. I met a guy in that class who I'll call Andy, and he invited me and my friend James and Russell to another men's group in Atlanta that is affiliated with the Sterling Men's Weekend.
Men harbor an inner battle, a secret fight with the demon, their macho underbelly, if you will. The battle is internal. The outer gentleman, the good guy, fights for civility and communication. The inner dude likes dominance and absolute control. Esteemed warriors of Team Gentlemen include James Bond, Bruce Wayne, and Robin Hood, when he was a fox. The axis of bro includes such notable figures as John Wayne, Rambo, and RoboCop. Indeed, Terminator 2 is the ultimate expression of this battle, of one cyborg's conversion to Team Gentleman, even after being programmed by the axis of bro.
I honestly, when he first asked me to go, I didn't really have a very clear sense of what it would be. He said basically it's going to be a cookout where the guys who had gone to the Sterling Men's Weekend were going to just basically talk about it. So I had in mind that it was going to be, you know, some sort of a recruitment.
Given Chris's esteemed and decorated standing in Team Gentlemen, I was really surprised when he told me the following story about his participation in a secret meeting of the machos. They tricked him and tried to convert him, officially. They used coercion and illicit tactics, hither unknown.
Little ritual that they wanted us to enact once we said yes. They wanted us to get on top of this log and then grab our balls and then scream at the top of our lungs, F it, I'm going to the Sterling Men's Weekend.
Thank you. show up to this pretty nice little park area in Atlanta. And so there's like a group of guys already like kind of around this like cookout area. So we're like kind of drudgingly get out of the car and like try and get motivated for like a real masculine time or whatever. So we show up and say hi to everyone. Basically, it was a bunch of older guys between 40 and 60, really. And there was one other young guy there about, like, close to our age. He was, like, I guess, 23. So they asked us where we were from, and, you know, we chatted for a little bit. But then the meeting was called to order, you know. And so the kind of younger man said, you know, let's just all formally introduce ourselves. So let's just go around the group and say our name, why we're here, who your sponsor is, like, who brought you to the group. And then after all that, I was kind of taken a little bit aback by this, but he said, you know, why don't you all just go ahead and tell us your favorite sexual position as well. So the kid, he introduced himself and, you know, said why he was here. I can't really remember that part, but I could tell that he was just sort of trying to rush through all of the formalities so he could, like, lose himself in describing his favorite sexual position. So he basically just cut through all the fat to get to talk about his sex position or whatever. And so he did that. And, you know, it was pretty weird. When it came around to me to tell everyone my favorite sexual position, I was, like, totally freaked out. I did not want to discuss that, actually, because I just thought it was a really strange thing to do when you were, like, meeting someone for the first time. Like, why would that be an obvious thing to share at a men's group on, like, an initial gathering? And it seemed really voyeuristic and violent to me. So I didn't really know what to do. I kind of wanted to just, like, call them out on it. Like, what is this, you know? But instead, like, I just said, well, you know, any sexual position is fine with me. But later on, I kind of wish that I had just called them out on that whole thing immediately and been like, guys, this is really weird. It seems really coercive.
These are not normal run-of-the-mill bros that you see in bars, not even super paranormal toxic bros that you might see in the street in cutoffs, catcalling women who walk by. These are fundamentalist bros, and they are trying to convert unsuspecting males in the secret of night. And these dudes then go out and bring others in for conversion.
I was like, what could possibly go next after that? So actually what was next was like this little sporting event that we all participated in. And I guess that was like perhaps to like sort of like loosen us up after like sort of a tense beginning. So we went across the street to this empty lot and played this like dorky game that was like sort of like ultimate frisbee, except you had to throw like a little squishy ball into a net that the goalkeeper was holding. So then after that, I guess we'd like kind of worked up our appetites. And so we had a meal of just hot dogs and hamburgers. And that was relatively uneventful. Like, I just made small talk with James and Russell. We kind of talked about other things, not like relating to what had just happened. I think we were actually trying to get our minds off of it a little bit, like trying to prepare ourselves for what was going to happen next. The introductory segment of the whole event has been so weird that I think we were ready for anything. I don't think we had any idea of what was going to happen.
The group is the Sterling Men's Institute. They are a masculinity cult, and to date, over 50,000 people have participated. The internet is teeming with discussion forums about this group. "I'm a very sad woman," one entry reads. "I was dating a wonderful man, and our relationship recently ended due to him joining this group. I say this because after his men's weekend, he returned drastically changed." Here's another entry. "Somebody close to me has become obsessed with this organization and has spent $1,500 to $2,000 attending weekends with older males in the mountains releasing testosterone. After attending a weekend with this group, the man in my life returned with bruises all over his upper body and no voice left from yelling."
I think it was about 8 o'clock by that point. I think there were 5 of us who had been brought as, like, recruits, who this was our first time at this group. You know, we were like, well, this is pretty weird, but I think we were willing to see it through and, like, see, like, perhaps the group was, like, is going to redeem itself and
you know, that was just like an initial aberration. Like, okay, well, you know, that was in really bad taste and not exactly the most enlightened way to go around producing like initial group feeling or group cohesion. We were all sort of standing or sitting around this campfire. The guy who had initially started the meeting, he kind of got things going again and said, well, he's all, well, the reason we're here tonight is basically to tell you all about the Men's Sterling Weekend and to encourage you to participate in it. So he said, well, this Men's Sterling Weekend has been like the most transformative experience of my whole life. It's something that I deeply want to share with you, this experience. But he's like, well, I want to encourage you guys to attend. And he said he couldn't tell us anything precisely about what had happened at the Men's Sterling Weekend since that was confidential. It could only be experienced. You couldn't hear about it directly. I think there was a sense in which we felt used. Like, well, so what? We're supposed to, like, share with you, like, our deepest, darkest sexual fantasies. And then you guys can't even tell us this, like, honest, spiritual, immense, affective awakening in your life that happens at the Men's Sterling Weekend. Like, I almost wanted to tell him, like, I don't know, that was really unfair. I think we all really wanted to know exactly what the whole thing was about. I didn't see myself wanting to go necessarily, but perhaps I did. Perhaps my curiosity was so piqued that I was contemplating it at the time.
The Sterling Institute was founded in 1979 in Oakland by a man named Justin Sterling. He started his career by counseling highly successful women about their relationships. Sterling has no university accreditation or experience. According to the website, he became an expert by, quote, informally counseling friends and associates who referred his services to others. Based on the popularity of his counseling, he started a motivational weekend retreat for women. His philosophy revolves around the belief that men and women can only achieve happiness by adopting proto-historic gender roles. Women are taught to take sole responsibility for the relationship and never question their husbands. Men are taught to make all decisions for the couple and never talk about their feelings or misgivings. Sterling does not draw his definitions of masculinity and femininity from any historical documents, though. They are intuitively understood, he argues, by society and biology at large. I see many cases, he claims, in an interview posted on the group's official website, where people seem to believe what they would like to be true about men and women, rather than what history and biology have proven is actually true. Sterling's concepts of belief and proof are unusual. The only documentation of these proofs are his beliefs. But that's okay. He's not a professor, just the leader of an organization that claims 50,000 members.
The next step is they basically cross-examine us one by one by, first of all, asking us, so what is it about your life that you're dissatisfied with, that you want to change? So they ask the first guy, Steve, what do you want to change about your life? And Steve starts talking about, like, his various life problems and dissatisfactions he wish he could change. And it was interesting because the guys who had been talking about the Men's Sterling Weekend talked about accessing your power, like accessing your true male power, like inherent in all men. And so Steve, when he started talking about like what he wanted in his life and stuff, he said, well, guys, like, I just wanted to tell you all that, like, everything that you've said sounds great, but my power comes from the Lord. And immediately when he said that, one of the guys, like, cut him off. And he was like, Steve, he's like, we understand that your power comes from the Lord. But what this Men's Sterling Weekend would do is to facilitate your relationship with the Lord and, like, make it much more intimate and sort of, like, unleash the power of your relationship to God. So Steve talked on for a little bit more, but then the guy who had interrupted him before kind of, like, snapped in again and was like, Steve, like, very poignantly, he's like, Steve, like, what's stopping you from just right now saying, F it, I'm going to the Men's Sterling Weekend. I'm taking the plunge. I'm committing now to go in October to upstate New York to participate in this, like, transformative weekend experience. I was kind of taken aback by the straightforwardness of the intensity of the way that this guy spoke. And Steve was, too. And so Steve said, well, he's like, well, I don't know, man. A lot of things are. Like, for example, it's expensive. It's $795 for 2 days, not including the plane ticket, lodging, etc. And then all of the other guys who had gone to the Sterling Beacon were like, Steve, we're your brothers, man. We're there for you, and we can make sure that you get up there. And so they were like, so basically you don't have any reason to say no. Like, you should just go ahead and say yes right now. Because what's stopping you? What's stopping you from making that crucial choice to change everything in your life for the better? At this point, I was looking over at my friend James, and we were like, man, this is really, really coercive. There's something, like, deeply, deeply disturbing about what's going on. At this point, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to say to these guys. I really don't know how I'm going to get out of this. Of course, it didn't occur to me, like, to just be like, whoa, just leave. Just, like, don't be a part of this. Just, like, say, man, like, man, I really got something to do right now. I just got to split. It just, like, it seemed impossible to make that sort of, like, very obvious choice. So I was just, like, frantically racing through my mind, like, what am I going to tell these guys?
The wide popularity of the Sterling Women's Weekend begat a men's weekend in 1981, which has since eclipsed its predecessor in popularity. There's a strict code of confidentiality to which participants must adhere. These are the facts. The tuition is $795. The weekend starts at 8 a.m. on Saturday and lasts until Monday morning. And then there's this, from the frequently asked questions portion of the Sterling Institute's official website. Question: I've heard there is nudity. Answer: the spontaneity and exuberance of the weekend sometimes leads men to engage in many different kinds of self-expression, occasionally including nudity. Question: I've heard there is a militaristic environment. Answer: the weekend has a few simple rules that allow for a smooth and productive experience for all. These rules are enforced rigidly. People who are not familiar with such a zero-tolerance policy often interpret this as a militaristic approach. Question: can I register without a sponsor? Answer: no. You must have a qualified sponsor to do the weekend.
So eventually it does come around to me, and they're like, Chris, what are some of the dissatisfactions and things that you want to change in your life? You know, tell us a little bit about that. And so I was like, man, you know what? I'm just going to play up to what they want to hear. So I was like, well, guys, to tell you all the truth, which is not nearly the truth, I was like, I got problems with the ladies. I want to have a more satisfying romantic life. I could just see, like, their eyes, like, gleam. And they were like, well, dude, guess what? Once you go to the Men's Sterling Weekend, dealing with women is never going to be a problem for you again. And I was just like, nice. Like, I need to get out of here so badly. I was like, okay, great. And then they did the same thing. They're like, Chris, what's stopping you right now from just taking the plunge? Just getting up on that stump and just saying, F it. I'm going to the Men's Sterling Weekend. And I was like, well, there's a lot stopping me. And they're like, well, what, man? Come on. Like, what could possibly be obstructing this glory that's yours for the taking, man? And I was like, well, you know, there's the price element. They were like, well, we just went through this, man. Like, we're your brothers. There are ways. There are ways to do this. And, of course, like, they didn't, you know, don't exactly specify the ways. So I was just like, you know what? Like, I would like to go. I just absolutely, at this point, I was just lying through my teeth. I was like, it seems like a really good idea. I'm, like, all for this or whatever. The problem is that I'm going to be out of the country next fall. So there's no chance I could go. I'm out of the country. So I just couldn't make it. I'm sorry. I couldn't make it. And then they were like, God, that sucks. Too bad for you. And then they went on to my friend James.
First-person accounts have leaked in various articles and internet forums. Here is a summary of a first-person account of the weekend, as reported on Rick Ross's Cold Awareness website. We recruits were ushered into a dimly lit auditorium. It was empty except for a number of women who repeatedly told us men the rules of the weekend. All 210 of us sat in silence for 40 minutes in a hot room until the crowd got anxious and started rebelling. A mutiny/riot broke out. Meanwhile, the whole thing was being videotaped. The men stormed the stage and took over the room. Men stood on the day and yelled at the crowd, pouring their hearts out. Eventually, it got hostile toward the women, and they were asked to leave.
We all felt the intensity of the coerciveness that was being imposed on us. It happened immediately. It wasn't like they even worked up to it. It was this immediate cross-examination. It was like a definite, why aren't you going to the men's Sterling weekend? What's stopping you from committing to this now without us knowing what the men's Sterling weekend is? Just an extremely superficial sense that, oh, well, it had really transformed everyone's life here. Therefore, logically, it's going to be a really transformative experience for us.
The first person account continues. After a few hours of this revolt, the room went dark, and a voice came over the loudspeakers. It was like the Wizard of Oz. The voice spoke for a while, and then the man behind the voice appeared and started lecturing us. It was Justin Sterling. He offered us what he called his $50 tips. They were as follows. Men don't have emotional needs. Women are only attracted to power and resources. Men marry for love. Women marry only for power. Problems are a woman's power status. The health of the relationship is the sole responsibility of the woman.
Both of the two guys who were not from our men and masculinity class succumbed. And even one guy, the one guy who had talked about his power coming from the Lord, I connected with this guy and like felt empathic towards him because he said, like, well, you know, I would like to talk about this with my wife. I just have like a lot of respect for her and want to discuss with her like me making that sort of expense. And he said, I know in advance that she's going to say okay, but it's just a matter of respect for her, like respect to her to discuss it and just let her know what I'm thinking. And I was like, yeah, man, like, wow, what an awesome guy. And I could tell that all the other guys from the Sterling weekend, that they were just like kind of inwardly like cringing, like, oh, come on, man, just like, just take the plunge, you know? And then they were, in the end, able to convince him to just do it.
The account goes on. Recruits were not allowed to leave to use the restroom unless it was for a number two. Men were told to stay in the room and urinate in garbage cans, which they did. This part of the weekend has apparently since been removed. Throughout the rest of the day, we performed a number of exercises that involved thinking about the women who'd hurt us and then screaming at each other. Men were screaming, breaking down and crying. By the end of the exercises, it was 2:30 a.m., the room was sweltering and reeked of body odor. Most men were shirtless.
Why were these guys so intent on getting all of us who had been brought to the meeting to make the decision right then and there? What was in it for them? The only conclusion that we came to about it was that somehow they were like on commission. I looked it up and I tried to find out if that was indeed true, but I couldn't tell. There's absolutely like a fundamentalist zeal about the whole thing, but rather than it being like for a specific religious orientation, it was for like the church of man, the church of the masculine.
The account concludes its summary. We were then sent to sleep and were awoken 3 hours later. We were ushered into a dark room and asked to meditate and to feel the oneness and the bond of being with men. People were asked to tell stories of grief to the whole room. They began to cry and we were instructed to comfort them, which was followed by group dancing. Anyone, no matter how strong-willed or educated, will, to some extent, succumb to these mind-control techniques. Don't feel overly confident that you can escape the influence. Also, there is strong pressure to recruit new members. Adherents are told that there is something lacking in their relationships if they cannot convince others to commit to the weekend.
All three of us who went down from our class, from our men and masculinity class, like, no, none of us was interested. I mean, like, yeah, I think we were interested in a way, but none of us committed to going in October, which seemed to be like the purpose of this meeting, was to get us to commit to go. After the group started to dissipate, like after they'd kind of gone at us each individually and they'd basically come to the conclusion that none of us three were going to take the plunge, one of the guys from the group came up to my friend and just like randomly said to him, no, man, I just can't see how any true, self-respecting man would ever be a proctologist. And I don't know why he felt compelled to say that, but I think it was sort of revealing of something about his psyche to say something like that.
We contacted the Sterling Institute, but they didn't call back for comment. This is typical of the organization. It rarely grants interviews. Here are some other facts you might want to know about Justin Sterling. Justin Sterling is not his real name. He changed his name from Arthur Kasergian in the 70s. Also in the 70s, he was convicted of money fraud by the federal government. Although he often cites high divorce rates as proof of the need to adopt his behavior models, he himself was divorced in 1994. He currently resides in California, a self-made multimillionaire.
I am not surprised that over 20,000 men have gone to the Sterling Men weekend. That doesn't surprise me in the least, because I can see how this sort of discourse would be extremely attractive. It turns out that the guy who was sort of leading the group, his dad was there. In fact, his dad was standing right next to him. And you know what? That's the weird part. Is like, honestly, the way, especially that the man who I found out was this guy's father, the way he spoke, it was like with this boldness that did seem in a way like strangely compelling and attractive. Like, wow, I mean, like, to be, like, to have, like, that sense of purpose or like, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like he was a master, you know? And who wouldn't want to be a master, I guess? It seemed halfway pretense and halfway, like, a sort of, like, honest embodiment of power. And so it was undeniable that there was an attractive element to it.
That feature was produced by Matt Kessler. The music in that piece was from the Chicago band All City Affairs. You can visit them online at www.allcityaffairs.com. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.